Welcome to Life Off Screen with Dan and Peggy Ruppel. Thank you for joining us. If you're enjoying this podcast, do us a favor and subscribe to the show and give us a rating. Life Off Screen is produced by Master Media International. And to find out more about Master Media or the Life Off Screen podcast, visit us at lifeoffscreen.com. And now, here's Dan and Peggy.
Hello and welcome to our show. We are so glad that you joined us today. Mm-hmm. Today, you're going to hear a powerful, tragic, but very redemptive testimony from our guests. And I want to mention right here at the top, if you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, I want to encourage you to listen to today's show or forward to somebody. It could change your life. Our guests today are contemporary Christian music legend, Russ Taff, and his wife, Tori. Russ was a member of the Imperials, and then he went on his solo career. And collectively, he has won 6 Grammy Awards. He's won 18 GMA, that's the Gospel Music Association, Dove Awards. And he's been inducted into the CMA, Contemporary Christian Music Association, Hall of Fame twice. Count him twice. One as a member of the Imperials and another as a solo artist.
Well, through it all, his wife, Tori, has not only stood by his side, and you'll hear how deeply that story is, but she's also been his writing partner. And recently they just won through ASCAP the Golden Note Award. Mm. We're gonna love telling you about their film, their award-winning film called I Still Believe. It is not to be missed.
Right, we were able to see a preview of the film in Nashville, and it was heartbreaking and so inspiring. Yes. as it comes to a conclusion. So we're gonna jump right in. We hope you enjoy the show and are impacted by it. Russ and Tori, it is so good to see you.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You look great.
Yes.
It's the angle.
It's the angle, yeah, yeah.
And well, I have the Brad Pitt lens on our
Oh, you do? Yeah. It's kind of the reverse of the virtual background. It's the virtual foreground. That suddenly makes us look far better than the years tell. Russ, we first met back in 1981. We were doing a show in Charlotte, a musical variety show called More Than Music. And it was you and Dave Boyer and Amy Grant was with us. And my Isaac Airfrey partner and I, we wrote the show. We did comedy through it. And we were, I think it was for about 4 months, we were off and on just kind of living, mm-hmm. you know, living back there, all of us together. And that's the first time I really got to know you and got to know you, Tori, and introduced you to Peggy also. Mm-hmm. But I remember the very first time I heard your voice live, Russ, it had such an emotional gravity to it.
Yes.
That the entire audience, including myself, it was just like shivers down your spine mm-hmm. when you heard your voice. And particularly, I wanted to reference the song We Will Stand, which I want you to tell the story of how you wrote that, what inspired it. But the entire audience was just almost in tears and united, helping you out in the chorus of that song. And you originally, and it's more relevant now than ever, you originally wrote it out of a response to racism.
Yes.
Right. I've always been fascinated with Amy McPherson and Catherine Kuhlman, and I got to see her when I was 18. She had a singer whose name was Archie Dennis, and he was an opera singer. Incredible voice, but he was black. And when I first saw her when I was 18, and I heard this big, beautiful voice, but I never heard an African-American sing opera. I mean, like that very trained vocal. And I heard a story after that he had been invited to a church in Alabama. And, you know, just listening on the radio, you heard him sing and he was awesome. And he was invited to this church in Alabama. And he got there Sunday morning, and before the pastor had just gotten there, and he started to set up his equipment, and had his little record table that he was setting up. And the pastor looked real nervous and real fidgety and finally came up to Archie and said, "Archie, this is not going to work." And he said, "Why? Why?" Now, he's been singing in front of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. He said, the pastor said, "Well, this is a white church. And we don't have blacks in here." And this was like, for him, it was like the late 60s, early 70s. And Archie, telling his story, he said, "I started tearing down my equipment, breaking it down, and tears just started running down my face." And he said, as I was carrying my equipment back to my car, and he was talking to Jesus, "Why? Why?" And he said he sat down on the steps of the church, just overwhelmed and tears rolling down his face, and just saying, "God, you know, we're all the same in your eyes. Why will they not let me in?" And he said he felt the Lord speak back to him and say, "Archie, they won't let me in either." And that just, I don't know, it just rung a chord. And that was the underlying theme when Tori and I started writing that.
I want to tell any of our viewers, if you haven't heard the song, "We Will Stand," go on Spotify or YouTube or something and listen to it, because the lyrics are so powerful. They're so uniting. And they're so honoring of each person who is made in the image of God, and a call for unity. And, and as I said earlier, it's more relevant now than maybe ever before.
It really feels like an anthem for our time. So thank you for that. You know, also, I wanted to mention that. So 37 years go by from that time. How could that possibly be?
From when we were working together on More Than Music.
More Than Music, 37 years. And we find ourselves at a conference together in Nashville in November. So
that was so cool.
It was just the best to steal away and to have lunch for 3+ hours. And we there was so much life to talk about. And this is where, and it felt like a day had not passed.
Yeah.
It was
absolutely.
Yeah, in the spirit.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, and I want to say, too, that this was where we first discovered, Russ, the depth of your struggle with alcohol, but also the childhood trauma that you had endured for so long. So if you don't mind unpacking that for us, what was it like for you growing up in the home of an alcoholic?
It was a real strict isolation from the rest of the world. And we were in church 4 nights a week and Sunday morning. So 5 times a week we were in church. And my dad, he loved to preach. So in that environment, and daddy preached a hard gospel, a hard gospel. And all my years knowing him was as this preacher, this man of God that preached a hard gospel and loved everybody.
Hard to live up to gospel, right?
Oh, Lord.
Impossible.
And it was a Saturday night, and daddy wasn't at church. And mama sent me home, and we lived 1/2 block from the church. And I went running home to get him to say, "Dad, church is starting. You know, you need to," mom said, "hurry up." But when I walked in the house, I heard this singing like I'd never heard before. And it was slurred and kind of off pitch. And I went back there and I saw him. I had no idea what drunk was. Mm-hmm. And it terrified me, because I would try to talk to him and he couldn't even focus on me. And I ran to church and told mom. And
something's wrong.
And mama excused herself and come, you know, running down there with me. And when she saw him, she just burst into tears saying, "Oh, Joe, oh, Joe." And I found out later that he had been an alcoholic before he became a Christian. Mm-hmm. And so he fell off the wagon. And that started his whole life. He never sobered up. So I was introduced to this world and the shame and the transferred shame of, you know, my whole world was singing. I couldn't play sports very well.
So your isolated world just gets all the more isolated.
And you can't talk outside the family. Daily, we got the message from mom and dad, and they were raising us just like they were raised. Every day, you're not worth a bullet to shoot you with. You're not worth the salt that goes in your bread.
Yeah.
And you will never amount to anything.
Right.
Daily. And after a while, you believe them.
The other secret in that family was violence. Mm-hmm. There was a tremendous amount of violence. I found out much later, after Russ had been treated for trauma, that it was almost daily. And it was from both parents. Mm. Again, they weren't monsters. They weren't.
They were raising us like they were raised.
And mm-hmm. They were dealing with addiction. They were dealing with marital issues. They were dealing with spiritual issues with no outside help, no outside input.
And we couldn't talk to anybody.
So it would come out, and the frustration of that would come out violent.
Right.
And there.
What is so remarkable about your story is, Russ, you're raised in this forced silence, being constantly told you're worthless, you're useless, you're not worth anything. You're physically abused, you're emotionally abused, and you also see the hypocrisy of the church, because as you said, he's preaching one thing on Sunday. And then he's doing a different thing on Monday. But many people, especially children, you think they would run from God. But you ran to God. You had a key to the church, and you would go in there. And that was truly your sanctuary.
Yes. Somewhere along the way, somebody has said that you could talk to Jesus as a friend. Somewhere I picked that up in my early life. And so we couldn't go to church anymore, but Mama had a key to the church. And so like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, I would sneak down there and, you know, unlock the church and go down in the dark. And I would either kneel at the altar or I would sit in a pew and I would just start talking to Jesus. And this gift that God had given me, because my world was music. Music was my escape. Music was my connection to God, and no TV, no radio.
What's amazing is that you hear, you're hearing these words of, you know, that you're not worth it. You know, you are just condemnation, and then it's like you start believing it, and then you start thinking all the bad things that happened to you. You deserve, because truly you aren't worth anything. And I know that was hard, because your mother was physically beating. There were some beatings involved that were just that kept reinforcing that isolation and silence. So you don't tell anybody anything.
You know, I was taught at a very early age, and I carried it into my first years of my career. You love him through service.
Mm.
You have to earn his love. No clue what grace was. You earned it. You worked your way, you know, into glory. And so.
And it could change at any time.
The rules.
And God would just, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, you could cut a car wreck and you're going to hell. You are, and you believe it.
So your parents move, and in, I guess it's 1971 or something, God ushers in kind of an adopted family. And then I think is that where you enter in, Tori, about that time?
Yes, Russ, we call Bud and June Smedley. God bless their sweethearts. She was Russ's teacher.
She saw what was going on.
And she saw what was going on. And when the family had to move back, he got kicked out of that church. Then Russ said, I can't go. But he was 17. Mm-hmm. He still had a year of school. And June says that she found herself saying, well, he can stay with us. So this little Pentecostal boy moved into this little Methodist family, and they literally wrapped their arms around him. I always told June the reason one of the main reasons we were able to stay married is because for this pivotal time in his life, he saw a functioning, normal family, a family that was mad at each other and then figure it out, a family that would have fun together, a family that would support each other and would tell their kids, you're so wonderful, you can do anything, let me help you find your dream, and all the things that that he wasn't able to get in his other family. So I was in high school, and there was Russ was working at a church that was set in a
Can I jump in just one second?
Jump all over the place.
I was up leading, you know, some songs with my acoustic guitar, and all of a sudden this blonde came walking in, and my world just went south. I mean, I could not. I lost my appetite for 3 days. I mean, I was.
This is big.
This is love.
Now, take it from there.
That losing his appetite thing always throws me a little.
No. I mean,
so I made you queasy, or?
No. I was madly in love.
Yeah.
So I was in the throes of teenage heartbreak, breaking up with the captain of the football team that I'd been dating in high school. And so I was having, you know, all of those pangs that you only have at 17. And I wasn't interested in dating anybody. And Russ, you crafty devil, was smart enough to know that I was not going to be real receptive to a new boyfriend. So he just became my buddy. And I didn't want to start dating anybody since I've been, involved in this.
You were still getting over a hard relationship.
And so Russ said, hey, I've got an idea. My little band is playing some little coffee houses and stuff around. So on weekends, why don't you just go with us? I knew all the guys. Why don't you just go with us? And then if somebody asks you out, you can say, oh, I have other plans. Like, well, that's a great idea.
Smart man.
So we, and he would call me at night when I would have trouble sleeping, and he would call. It always seemed like he knew just when to call. And we would talk about my teenage heartbreak. He would tell me funny, crazy stories about he and his brothers and things, all the things that boys, five boys left alone in a house with two working parents would do. And it was just easy, and it was a safe place. Even though I knew there were hardships and I knew about his dad, I didn't have any idea of the level of pain until we were on into the marriage.
So you got married on a surprising date.
Yeah, that was thanks to the Imperials. We got married on Halloween. We're all joke there. Yeah, we had to. They took over Russ, the guy he was replacing in the Imperials, left a little early once he knew that they had had somebody. And so he had to jump in and fulfill the dates that were already on the calendar. And one of them happened to be our wedding date. So we had to
I don't know if this is a see you and raise you one, but
we had the same kind of thing.
We had something come up.
Isaac Airfree was going to play at Knott's Berry Farm. On our date, we were to get married. We were going to get married April 8th, and we recalculated, and we got married April Fool's Day, April 1st. So.
But nobody ever forgets
you. No,
never.
No one forgets. That's right.
Yeah.
But you know, just to inject this real quick, and I can let Tori keep going, but what connected us back then, years and years ago, was my love for Jesus and your love for Jesus.
Yes.
Connected. We could talk about spiritual things. And, you know, it wasn't common for guys to talk about Jesus at a young age. I mean, you know, all that stuff going on. But your love for Christ and talking about it, my love for Christ and talking about it, we just really connected back then.
You did.
Yeah. And the same thing with us. I mean, obviously, I thought she was absolutely beautiful. But, you know, we fell in love with each other's love for Christ. And that was the bond,
so
the glue. I want to circle back. You're married. Tori's going on the road with you, traveling with you as you're with the Imperials, hugely successful, winning awards and packed audiences and stuff. Again, coming from that background of being drummed into you, you are worthless. You are, you deserve some of these things. And suddenly to get that level of adulation and affirmation, how did you process all of that?
Well, I acted like I pushed everything from my childhood away and acted like it didn't happen. I tried to, but there was so much rage in me and turmoil, and you don't know what to do with it. You haven't heard the word therapy, and I didn't know what alcoholism was. But I was living in such hell because I was being heralded. You go to work and 10,000 people are telling you you're wonderful, but in your gut, if they knew, they wouldn't come if they knew me, because I'm not good. I'm not worth this praise. Mm-hmm. So you have all this angst in you, and you love Jesus and you're singing about him and you're talking about him and you feel some relief while you're doing that. But then you go back to the hotel and honestly, I would be saying, do you like me now? I did my best.
Breaks my heart.
And people came to Christ. And, people made decisions to serve you. Am I good enough? Do you think I'm good now? I mean, I really worked hard for you. And so there was just this pain inside of me. And we were in New York. They would have Heineken in the refrigerator. I'll just drink this and it'll cool me down. Well, I drank one and I started feeling something. And the voices got a little bit quieter. That rage, that hurt, that pain, that discontent, that restlessness got a little quieter. So I had another one. And the voices got more silent. And so I had the last one, the third one. And the pain wasn't there that much. The hurt wasn't there that much. Those voices of like, you're not worth it. But not there as much. And I promise the next day I lifted my hands and I started praising God. I said, I can live this way. The hurt is gone, the pain is gone, the discontent, the restlessness, the rage, it's gone.
I
can live this way. This must be how other people feel.
For now.
I started this career of just, and then, after a short time, it gets a hold of you. And it's not euphoric anymore. It becomes painful and hurtful. And you start lying. And you start covering for addiction. And then your body is craving it. And then you start feeling like the worst hypocrite in the world.
Right.
You
grew up in a family that is telling you, you've got to stay silent. You don't let our secrets out. Yeah. And now you're going to transfer that right over to alcoholism. It's like, I got to keep it secret. So Tori, what was your process at this time? Were you starting to get hints? Did you recognize it right away? Or
I didn't see him under the influence until probably 20 years down the road.
Wow.
I thought he was Kroger's a lot, but he would leave the house. He would be gone. What I started noticing is the isolation and the disconnect. And our joke with Russ even now is that he's an introvert trapped in an extrovert's career. So the fact that he would want to kind of be up by himself some was not all that weird. It was something when he came home from being on the road and around people all the time, he kind of, that part started increasing. And he became sullen and he became just distant. And I didn't I got to the point that I could tell, we're losing this. I don't know who, I don't know who you are. I don't know what's going on. I can't reach you. And it's like shadow boxing. There's something fighting you, and you, it doesn't have a form, and you don't know who the enemy is. All I knew is that this man that I loved was becoming unrecognizable. He was never violent in our home. There was never any physical violence in our home. But emotionally, he was very angry and punishing, and he took all of that self-hatred and would aim it outward. And,
I was doing to her exactly what my mom and dad did to me. They traumatized me, and I started traumatizing her. And that's still one thing to this day and all these years of sobriety. It still breaks my heart. If the pain that I caused her was the pain that they caused me. And I didn't realize that at the time, but I had my hands around her throat, just choking her to death.
Metaphorically.
I never touched her physically, but that's one of the hardest things to get over, that I did that to someone I love so desperately.
My father was an alcoholic, and his father before him was more of a derelict alcoholic. So there was vows my mother and father made to each other that they will never walk through what they experienced. And of course, raised in that home, there were defaults. So when my dad had a failed business and some other things, this was the numbing, what you explained was what happened to him. But I'm hearing in your voice every now and then, my mom says, I wish I had the tools. I wish I knew sooner. And I get to embrace her.
It's all right.
Russ, what was the tipping point? What was the time that you said, I surrender, I got to get help, and it put you into rehab?
It happened several times. The first time, I had got to the point, I would try to shave without looking myself in the face. I could not look myself in the face because I turned into everything I said I would never turn into. I was doing the same thing that I said I would never do because of them. And it was like I was living a dual role. I was in this hell. I was in this turmoil and hating myself. And then I would have to change characters and walk up on that stage. And everything I said, I believed, but I was far from it.
To be fair, I just want to interject this. You never stood on a stage and preached.
No.
You have to do this, and God doesn't love you unless you measure up.
No.
You didn't stand on a stage and speak or preach a hard gospel about a hard God. You stood on a stage and you sang and talked about a God of love and grace and forgiveness. You just couldn't do that for yourself.
I had become so different, distant from Tori. And my world all around me was in ashes. I had burnt everything down. But she was the last thread of sanity. And if I lost her, I would spin off to oblivion and drug my brain myself to death. And she had seen a lawyer. And she said, I don't know if I can live this way anymore. And that terrified me because I was so terrified to lose that little thread of someone that loved me, you know?
By the time we had our first child, there had been a long period of sobriety, and I felt solid enough.
To trust me.
To trust you. And that we had Maddie Rose, who was the most wonderful thing that ever happened to us until 4 years later when we had Charlotte. And I saw him be the father that he wasn't. He wasn't given. The girls now even laughed. You know, the kind of the thing about mom's usually the disciplinarian, dad's the soft touch. That's like in spades around here. Because he was so tender towards the children. And by the time the last time that Russ went to treatment, his mother had died And there was...
That was 9 years later.
Yeah. And he, the wheels came off. There wasn't anybody to protect anymore. Mm-hmm. You don't want to sit in Nashville and hate these two little old white-haired people in California.
With no education and just love Jesus for crazy.
So you just stuff it down. Well, then they're gone and you don't have to protect that anymore. And when his mom died, the memories and the pain came flooding out, and stories that I hadn't heard, I thought I'd heard all of them ad nauseum in therapy, stories that I hadn't heard. I started realizing the extent of the violence, the extent of the, and it was like he couldn't get sober. It was, there was a vengeance. It was scary. I just wanted to shake it out of him. I was saying, this isn't who you are. Yes. This isn't who you are. And in his despair and addiction, he would say, yes, it is.
Mm. And I'm a TAF. This is what we do. We destroy him.
And yeah. By the time he in the movie, in the documentary, there's a very private and personal scene that we made a decision to allow to be in the film, and that is literal video of Russ on stage drunk. It happened.
Can I say, that was the line I would never cross. I would never cross, even on the road when I was drinking. It would be at the hotel waiting for me, and I did not want to be around pastors, promoters with this anger and this rage, and then liquor on my breath.
And he couldn't keep the lid on it anymore. And there was a videotaping of a concert, multi-artist concert, and Russ was going to be the big finale.
Singing Praise the Lord at the end of it.
And and he left, and he had some drinks ahead of time, he said, and then he left and had some more and came in late. And he'd always been able to control it, but the nature of addiction is that it is beyond your control. And that night, it was very much beyond his control. And he walked out on stage impaired.
In front of the industry, in front of all the others, artists.
All your peers.
Yeah. And the industry from the town came. I mean, it was a big night.
Yeah. And what was remarkable, hearing your story you've told us, but also in the film, is the artists, the Nashville Christian music community, they didn't get ticked off at you. Instead, they just rallied around you with such love and grace and understanding, and they just went to prayer.
They closed ranks. They got him off the stage, and they got him home. So I was home and didn't have any idea what was going on, and they brought him in, and he went to treatment for the last time. And but even Bill Gaither, who's a friend of 1,000 years, Bill said, Russ called Bill and told him what had happened and said that he was going to treatment the next day. And Bill, to this day, says, I have never seen the industry do this. He said, in other circumstances, I would have had a phone call from somebody before you were off the stage.
And gossip and talk and, you know, because I thought that night when I sobered up the next day, my career's over.
Who
the world is going to. But, I mean, Gloria Gaither always told me, she said, you're the only person I know that has been loved by God and loved by the body of Christ.
I cried at that moment, Tori, in the film, because it was a holy moment. I mean, that God came around you and that people protected you. It was like the body of Christ at their best.
Yes.
At Trauma Campus, Tori called it. After 2 weeks, I cried for the next 3 weeks because there was this pile of hurt and pain and anger and rage. And they would take one piece at a time and put it over here, and I could let it go. And they did that.
And look at it and talk about it.
And name it. And name it. That's so powerful.
And so that had gone on, and I stayed another 30 days because I was changing. I was changing. I started having empathy for my parents.
Through that counseling, you got to the root. of what was causing all of this. One of the most beautiful parts of the film, and you have also told us personally this story, and I want you to share it, is that was wonderful, that healing that root, getting to that root, identifying it. But then the wonderful cap on it all was receiving the blessing of the Father through you went into a hospital room of a dying pastor. And can you tell that story?
Dina, his longtime, Mark Lowry's longtime childhood friend,
she's Mark's best friend. And she was at their little retreat with us, and her pastor was in the hospital with cancer. They asked her if I would consider coming to the hospital. He loved the DVD that Gaither mm-hmm. did on it. He loved the songs, and he asked me if I would come. I grabbed my guitar, and we got to the hospital room, and the son met me, and he explained to me what was going on. And I said, okay, you know, and he loved the DVD and loved my voice. So I opened the door to go in and I froze. Mm-hmm. I stopped dead in my tracks because he was, you know, white hair, blue eyes, tall man, big hands, and was, I froze and I wanted to turn and run.
It was a startling resemblance to his father.
When we first started talking, he said, Russ, I have cancer, and if God doesn't heal me, I'm going to die. He said, but I've taught my boys how to live. Mm-hmm. And if God doesn't heal me, I'm going to teach my boys how to die. And when I finished, I said, Pastor Jones, would you pray for me? And I wanted to grab those words and bring it back because I knew he was tired. Mm-hmm. And he hid in his face and he said, oh, Russ, I'd love to pray for you. And he stands up out of
his bed. They helped him get out and wanted out of his bed to
so
stand
he
up.
Could stand up.
Stand up.
I'm looking up into his blue eyes. My dad was 6'2". I looked up into his eyes like I would my dad. He placed his big hands on my shoulders, just like dad. You know, and he started praying, and I started crying, just, and then after a while, just crying uncontrollably, and I collapsed down to my knees, and I was crying from way, way, way down deep in my soul. I mean, I was wailing and crying, and
pain was rolling out.
It was just rolling out, and then he began to affirm me. Like a father would have done. He said, Russ, God is so pleased with you and what you've done with your life. And I, you know, you have ministered to me. And this just started affirming, you know, I'm so glad you did this. I'm so glad you did
you
that.
You used your talent
for Jesus.
And he's so proud of you. And he just.
And the more he did it, the deeper I cried.
The blessing of the Father. You're getting the blessing of the Father.
Yes,
your heavenly Father, but and
you heard,
visibly,
you lived a lifetime of hearing lies,
yes.
And suddenly the truth was pronounced over you, and that's what brought the final healing.
Yes,
and the mercy and the mercy of God and the personal touch of God is that He did it through a human pastor father who looked like his dad.
Yes,
isn't that amazing? That is so amazing.
That is so authored. That is such a God-authored moment. Sovereign before the foundations of the world.
It's like the Lord dealt with my body.
Mm.
And then the Lord dealt with my soul. And then that day, Jesus healed my spirit.
Even in your struggles, there was an anointing over you that that you were holding fast to what you know to be true about God, even though it sifted through your hands, you knew it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And that emanated from your music always. And I marvel. Goodness of God.
Started in the early years, you know, 12 and 13, developing a relationship with Jesus that I talked to him about fear. I talked to him about pain and hurt. Even those nights when I was drunk, I was still talking to him. You know, I thought he hated me. They told me he did, but I would talk to him and I would tell him what was going on, how scared I was, and all of those things that I went through as a child. I was telling him like an adult. Mm-hmm. And I felt his presence.
And to anybody out there who's walking through whatever your valley is, addiction and
trauma, whatever.
Mm-hmm. He just never left. He just never left. He was always with us.
That was the incredible part. He never walked away from me. And I knew he would. But
so I just wanted in the last minute to just encourage anyone out there who's in a painful state. Like I said, I wish we had just prayed once and it was fixed. It didn't work that way for us, but God led us from person to treatment, to therapist, to friend, to his hand, when you look back, is everywhere. And every time we were at the end, he would give us the next right thing to do. So look for those next right things to do, because help and wholeness is out there for you.
I felt about 5 years ago that you can edit this if you need to, but the Lord was saying, I think it's time you tell your story. And but I didn't know it would be this. But as I've been going out all these years, you know, after all this, and I tell people, and I tell my secret, I tell my secret. And for some reason, they feel safe to tell me theirs. Mm-hmm. And because we hold our fear and our hurt and our trauma inside, and we won't let it out. And healing comes when we trust one person.
Yes.
One person. And I say, find somebody that's been broken and God's putting their life back together. They won't judge you. They'll listen to you. But you've got to start letting it out and telling someone. Yes. But it's after we go out periodically and we do like a night where we show the DVD and then Tori and I do a question and answer time. But and even in my solo concert, sharing some of this, people come up to me when the concert's over and I'm back at the product table and I'm accessible, and they will lean in and whisper in my ear. They will say bulimia.
Mm. Oh so, my goodness!
Sexual addiction or sexual
incest survivor.
Incest survivor, and they'll share with me their secret and say it out loud for the first time.
Yes.
But healing comes when we come away from the secret and tell the secret, and it breaks its power. And that starts the road to recovery, is just exposing the secret to someone you trust.
We want to encourage our viewers. You can catch it, I Still Believe. We saw it on Amazon. I don't know if there's other platforms, but you can definitely see it. I want to fast forward to what you're doing now because it's so fun, and Peggy and I are dying to get there and be with you.
We're working out.
But
talk
about your bell buckle weekend.
Well, 7 years ago, we moved an hour out of Nashville. We've been in Nashville since the Imperials. To this funky, quirky, little, tiny town. I'm a city girl, never lived any place small. This is a population of about 450 people. Most of the artists. It has always had a thriving arts community, and it's just full of wonderful weirdos. We fit in.
You're
farmers, professors, artists. It's wonderful. So we started 5 years. Oh, my gosh. It'd be 5 years ago almost. We wanted to do a friends and fans weekend. We wanted to keep it intimate, and we started Russ and Tori's Bell Buckle Weekend. And it's a Saturday night, which is the, you know, now that we're old, we're classic CCM, not CCM. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So Saturday night, we do a big buffet, Southern feast. It's at the banquet hall, which is where I work as an event planner. And then we have the classic CCM concert with Russ and a full band, some of his original band members. And then Sunday morning, we've got a big gospel buffet, and then we have more of a Gaither-oriented kind of southern part of his roots with artists who, and we've had Mark, and we've had Bill. Bart Millard, and we've had Michael Tate, and we've had all of these friends that Russ did favors for all those years. We call them. Yeah. But, it's been amazing. And this year we've moved it to November 14, 15, which is the first weekend in October. But we're giving as much grace as time as we can
for COVID.
For COVID, to make sure everyone's right. comfortable coming. So this year it'll be, and it's there's a website, rustcalfweekend.com, and anything that you see on Facebook and all that, there's always directions to it. But it has turned into the most fun thing we do all year.
Yeah.
Well, we're, like I said, we are so hoping we can get there and join you. I want to thank you so much for opening your hearts, opening your lives to us, opening your friendship to us. And we appreciate it so, so much. And I want to say, I referenced your voice, Russ, at the beginning. And Johnny Cash once said about Linda Ronstadt, he said, "This is the young girl who has a tear in her voice." And that was like the secret to you know, the passion, emotion in her voice. And I feel the same way about you. In your voice, you can hear a man who has been broken by life, but is in great gratitude to the wholeness that has been brought by the love and grace and mercy of Jesus. And that just emanates with every song you sing.
Profound. You guys.
Thank you. We love you guys, and we sure hope we can see you soon.
We love you guys.
Love you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for Life Off Screen with Dan and Peggy Ruppel. Life Off Screen is produced by Master Media International. Our technical director is Jason Rugg. Please subscribe to the Life Off Screen YouTube channel or subscribe to the Life Off Screen podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave your comments in the comment section. And to find out more about Master Media, go to mastermedia.com. Thanks again for joining us. Hope to see you next time.